Chapter 4. We've been ordered up the line on wiring duty. The trucks turn up for us as soon as it gets dark. We scramble aboard. It is a warm evening. The twilight is like a blanket wrapped around us, and we feel comforted by this protection. It brings us closer together. Even Chardon, who is usually a bit stingy, gives me a cigarette and lights it for me. We stand next to one another, packed tightly, and no one can sit down. We aren't used to sitting down anyway. At last, Muller is in a good mood again. He is wearing his new boots. The engines rev up, the trucks rattle and clatter. The road surfaces are worn out and full of holes. No lights are allowed, and so we run into the holes, and all but get thrown out of the truck. That possibility doesn't bother us much. What would it matter? A broken arm is better than a hole through the belly, and plenty of us would actually welcome a chance like that to get sent home. Alongside us, long columns of munition trucks are moving up. They are in a hurry and keep on overtaking us. We shout out jokes to the men and they answer us. We make out a wall which belongs to a house set a little way back from the road. Suddenly I prick up my ears. Can it be true? Then I hear it again, perfectly clearly. Geese! A glance towards Kaczynski, a glance back from him. We understand each other. Kat, I think I can hear a candidate for the cooking pot. He nods. We'll do it when we get back. I know my way around here. Of course Kat knows his way around. I bet he knows every drumstick on every goose for miles. The trucks reach the firing area. The gun emplacements are camouflaged with greenery against air reconnaissance, and it all looks like a military version of that Jewish festival where they build little huts outdoors. These leafy bowers would look peaceful and cheerful if they didn't have guns inside them. The air is getting hazy with smoke from the guns and fog. The cordite tastes bitter on the tongue. The thunder of the artillery fire makes our truck shake. The echo rolls on after the firing and everything shudders. Our faces change imperceptibly. We don't have to go into the trenches, just on wiring duty. But you can read it on every face. This is the front. We're within reach of the front. It isn't fear. Not yet. Anyone who's been at the front as often as we have gets thick-skinned about it. Only the young recruits are jumpy. Kat gives them a lesson. That was a 12-inch. You can hear that from the report. You'll hear the burst in a minute. But the dull thud of the shell bursts can't be heard at this distance. Everything is swallowed up in the rumble of the front. Kat listens carefully. There'll be a show tonight. We all listen. The front is restless. Tommy's already firing, says Krop. You can hear the guns clearly. It is the British batteries to the right of our sector. They are starting an hour early. Ours never start until 10 on the dot.
What's up with them?
Calls out Muller.
Are their watches fast or something?
There'll be a show, I tell you. I can feel it in my bones. Kat shrugs his shoulders. Three guns thunder out just beside us. The gun flash shoots away diagonally into the mist. The artillery roars and rumbles. We shiver, happy that we'll be back in camp by tomorrow morning. Our faces are no more flushed and no paler than they usually are. They are neither more alert nor more relaxed. And yet they are different. We feel as if something inside us, in our blood, has been switched on. That's not just a phrase. It is a fact. It is the front, the awareness of the front that has made that electrical contact. The moment we hear the whistle of the first shells, or when the air is torn by artillery fire, a tense expectancy suddenly gets into our veins, our hands and our eyes, a readiness, a heightened wakefulness, a strange suppleness of the senses. All at once, the body is completely ready. It often seems to me as if it is the disturbed and vibrating air that suddenly comes over us with silent force, or as if the front itself is sending out its own electricity to put those unconscious nerve endings onto the alert. It is the same every time. When we set out, we are just soldiers. We might be grumbling or we might be cheerful. And then we get to the first gun emplacements, and every single word that we utter takes on a new sound. If Kat stands in front of the huts and says, there's going to be a show, then that is his own opinion, nothing else. But if he says it out here, then the same words are as sharp as a bayonet on a moonlit night, cutting straight through the normal workings of the brain, more immediate, and speaking directly to that unknown element that has grown inside us with a dark significance. There's going to be a show. Perhaps it is our innermost and most secret life that gives a shudder, and then prepares to defend itself. For me, the front is as sinister as a whirlpool. Even when you are a long way away from its centre, out in calm waters, you can still feel its suction pulling you towards it, slowly, inexorably, meeting little resistance. But the power to defend ourselves flows back into us out of the earth and out of the air, and most of all it flows out of the earth. The earth is more important to the soldier than to anybody else. When he presses himself to the earth, long and violently, when he urges himself deep into it with his face and with his limbs, under fire and with the fear of death upon him, then the earth is his only friend, his brother, his mother. He groans out his terror and screams into its silence and safety. The earth absorbs it all and gives him another 10 seconds of life, 10 seconds to run, then takes hold of him again, sometimes forever. Earth. 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 Earth, with your ridges and holes and hollows into which a man can throw himself, where a man can hide. Earth. In the agony of terror, the explosion of annihilation, in the death roar of the shell bursts, you gave us that massive resurgence of reconquered life. The madness, the tempest of an existence that had practically been torn to shreds, flowed back from you into our hands, and so we burrowed deep into you for safety. And in the speechless fear and relief of having survived the moment, our mouths bit deeply into you. With the first rumble of shellfire, one part of our being hurls itself back 1,000 years. An animal instinct awakens in us, and it directs and protects us. It is not conscious. It is far quicker, far more accurate and far more reliable than conscious thought. You can't explain it. You are moving up, not thinking of anything. Then suddenly you are in a hollow in the ground with shrapnel flying over your head, but you can't remember having heard the shell coming or having thought about taking cover. If you had relied on thought, you would have been so many pieces of meat by now. It was something else, some prescient, unconscious awareness inside us that threw us down and saved us without our realizing. But for this, there would long since have been not a single man left alive between Flanders and the Vosges. We set out as soldiers, and we might be grumbling or we might be cheerful. We reached the zone where the front line begins, and we have turned into human animals. We move into a rather scrappy wood. We pass the field kitchens. Just beyond the wood, we climb down from the trucks and they go back. They will pick us up again before first light tomorrow. Mist and smoke from the artillery is chest high over the meadows. The moon is shining on it. Troops are moving on the roadway. The steel helmets give a dull reflection in the moonlight. Heads and rifles stick out from the white mists, nodding heads and swaying rifle barrels. Further on, the mist clears. The heads turn into whole figures. Tunics, trousers and boots come out of the mist as if from a pool of milk. They form into a column. The column marches straight ahead. The figures become a wedge, and you can no longer make out individual men, just this dark wedge, pushing forwards, made even more strange by the heads and rifles bobbing along on the misty lake. A column. Not men. Light artillery and munition wagons move in from a side road. The backs of the horses shine in the moonlight and their movements are good to see. They toss their heads and their eyes flash. The guns and the wagons glide past against an indistinct background like a lunar landscape, while the steel-helmeted cavalrymen look like knights in armour from a bygone age. Somehow it is moving and beautiful. We make for the equipment dump. Some of our men load the angled, sharpened iron uprights onto their shoulders. The rest stick straight iron bars through rolls of barbed wire and carry them away. They are awkward and heavy loads. The terrain gets more pitted. Reports come back to us from up ahead.
Watch where you're going. There's a deep shell hole on the left. Mind the trench.
We keep our eyes wide open and test the ground with our feet and with the bars before we put all our weight down. The column stops suddenly. You bang your face into the barbed wire roll that the man in front is carrying and you swear. A couple of shot-up trucks are in the way. A new order comes.
Pipes and cigarettes out!
We are close to the front-line trenches. In the meantime, it has gone completely dark. We skirt around a little copse, and our sector is there before us. There is an indistinct reddish glow from one end of the horizon to the other. It changes constantly, punctuated by flashes from the gun batteries. Very lights go up high above it, silver and red balls which burst with a shower of white, red and green stars. French rockets shoot up, the ones with silk parachutes that open in the air and let them drift down really slowly. They light up everything as clear as day, and their brightness even reaches across to us, so that we can see our shadows stark against the ground. The lights hang in the sky for minutes at a time before they burn out. New ones shoot up at once, everywhere, and there are still the green, red and blue stars.
"Going to be a bad do," says Cat.
The thunder of the guns gets stronger until it becomes a single dull roar, and then it breaks down again into individual bursts. The dry-voiced machine guns rattle. Above our heads, the air is full of invisible menace, howling, whistling, and hissing. This is from the smaller guns, but every so often comes the deep sound of the big crump shells, the really heavy stuff, moving through the dark and landing far behind us. They make a bellowing, throaty, distant noise, like a rutting stag, and they go far above the howl and the whistle of the small shells. Searchlights begin to sweep the black sky. They skim across it like huge blackboard pointers, tapering down at the bottom. One of them pauses, shaking a little. At once another is beside it. They cross, and there is a black winged insect trapped and trying to escape. An airman. He wavers, is dazzled, and falls. We ram the iron posts in firmly at set intervals. There are always two men holding the roll, while the others pay out the barbed wire. It is that horrible wire with a lot of long spikes close together. I am out of practice at paying it out and rip my hand open. After a few hours, we have finished. But there is still some time before the trucks are due. Most of us lie down and sleep. I try to as well, but it is too cold. You can tell that we are not far from the sea, because you are always waking up from the cold. At one point I do fall into a deep sleep. When I wake up suddenly with a jolt, I have no idea where I am. I see the stars and I see the rockets, and just for a moment I imagine that I have fallen asleep in the garden at home during a fireworks party of some sort. I don't know whether it is morning or evening, and I lie there in the pale cradle of dawn, waiting for the gentle words which must surely come, gentle and comforting. Am I crying? I put my hand to my face. It is baffling. Am I a child? Smooth skin. It only lasts for a second, and then I recognize the silhouette of Kaczynski. He is sitting there quite calmly, old soldier that he is, smoking his pipe. One of those with a lid over the bowl, of course. When he sees that I am awake, he says,
"That made you jump. It was only a detonator, and whizzed off into the bushes over there."
I sit up. I feel terribly alone. It is good that Cat is there. He looks thoughtfully at the front and says,
"Lovely fireworks. If only they weren't so dangerous."
A shell lands behind us. A couple of the new recruits jump up in fright. A few minutes later, another shell comes over, closer than before. Cat knocks out his pipe.
"Here we go."
It has started. We crawl away as fast as we can. The next shell lands amongst us. Some of the men scream. Green rockets go up over the horizon. Dirt flies up. Shrapnel buzzes. You can hear it landing when the noise of the blast has long gone. Close by us, there is a recruit, a blonde lad, and he is terrified. He has pressed his face into his hands. His helmet has rolled off. I reach for it and try to put it onto his head. He looks up, pushes the helmet away, and huddles in under my arm like a child, his head against my chest. His narrow shoulders are shaking, shoulders just like Kemmerish had. I let him stay there. But to get some use out of his helmet, I shove it over his backside, not as some kind of a joke, but deliberately, because it's the most exposed area. Even though the flesh is solid, a wound there can be bloody painful, and besides, you have to lie on your stomach for months in a military hospital, and afterwards you are pretty certain to have a limp. There's been a direct hit somewhere not far off. Between the impacts, you can hear screaming. At last, it calms down. The shellfire has swept over us and moved on to the back line of reserve trenches. We risk a lookout. Red rockets are shimmering in the sky. Probably there will be an attack. It stays quiet where we are. I sit up and shake the recruit by the shoulder.
It's all over, old son. We've got through again.
He looks around in bewilderment.
You'll get used to it, I tell him.
He notices his helmet and puts it on his head. Slowly he comes to himself. Then suddenly he blushes scarlet and his face has a look of embarrassment. Cautiously he puts his hand to his rear end and gives me an agonized look. I understand at once. The barrage scared the shit out of him. That wasn't the precise reason that I put his helmet where I did, but all the same I comfort him.
No shame in that. Plenty of soldiers before you have filled their pants when they came under fire for the first time. Go behind that bush. Chuck your underpants away. And that's that.
He clears off. It gets quieter, but the screaming doesn't stop.
What's up, Albert? I ask.
A couple of the columns over there got direct hits.
The screaming goes on. And on.
It can't be men. They couldn't scream that horribly.
Wounded horses, says Cat.
I have never heard a horse scream, and I can hardly believe it. There is a whole world of pain in that sound. Creation itself under torture. A wild and horrifying agony.
We go pale.
Dettering sits up.
Bastards! Bastard! For Christ's sake, shoot them!
He is a farmer and used to handling horses. It really gets to him. And as if on purpose, the firing dies away almost completely. The screams of the animals become that much clearer. You can't tell where it is coming from any more in that quiet, silver landscape. It is invisible, ghostly. It is everywhere, between the earth and the heavens. And it swells out immeasurably. Dettering is going crazy and roars out,
"Shoot them, for Christ's sake, shoot them!"
They've got to get the wounded men out first, says Cat.
We stand up and try to see where they are. If we can actually see the animals, it will be easier to cope with. Meyer has some field glasses with him. We can make out a dark group of orderlies with stretchers, and then some bigger things, black mounds that are moving. Those are the wounded horses. But not all of them. Some gallop off a little way, collapse, and then run on again. The belly of one of the horses has been ripped open and its guts are trailing out. It gets its feet caught up in them and falls. But it gets to its feet again. Dettering raises his rifle and takes aim. Cat knocks the barrel upwards.
Are you crazy?
Dettering shudders and throws his gun onto the ground. We sit down and press our hands over our ears. But the terrible crying and groaning and howling still gets through. It penetrates everything. We can all stand a lot, but this brings us out in a cold sweat. You want to get up and run away, anywhere just so as not to hear that screaming anymore. And it isn't men, just horses. Some more stretchers are moved away from the dark mass. Then a few shots ring out. The big shapes twitch a little and then become less prominent. At last. But it isn't over yet. No one can catch the wounded animals who have bolted in terror, their wide-open mouths filled with all that pain. One of the figures goes down on one knee, a shot. One horse collapses, and then there is another. The last horse supports itself on its forelegs and moves in a circle like a carousel, turning around in a sitting position with its forelegs stiff. Probably its back is broken. The soldier runs across and shoots it down. Slowly, humbly, it sinks to the ground. We take our hands away from our ears. The screaming has stopped. Just a long, drawn-out, dying sigh is still there in the air. Then, just like before, there are only the rockets, the singing of the shells and the stars. And it feels almost eerie. Dettering walks about, cursing.
What have they done to deserve that? That's what I want to know.
And later on he comes back to it again. His voice is agitated and he sounds as if he is making a speech when he says,
I tell you this, it is the most despicable thing of all to drag animals into a war.
We go back. It's time to head for the trucks. The sky has become just a trace lighter. 3 a.m. The wind is fresh and cool, and at that livid hour our faces look grey. We move slowly forwards in Indian file through the trenches and shell holes, and at last we reach the foggy area once again. Kaczynski is uneasy, and that is a bad sign.
What's the matter, Kat? Asks Krop.
I just wish we were home.
Home. He means back in camp.
Won't be long now, Kat.
He is nervous.
I don't know.
We get to the communication trenches and then back to the meadows. The little wood is in front of us. We know every inch of ground here. We can already see the graves of the rifle brigade, with the mounds of earth still piled up and the black crosses. At that very moment, we hear a whistling noise behind us. It gets louder. There is a crash and then a roar. We've ducked down. 100 yards in front of us, a wall of flame shoots up. The next moment, part of the wood is lifted up above the treetops when the second shell hits. 3 or 4 trees go up with it and are smashed into pieces in the process. The follow-up shells are already hissing down with a sound like a safety valve. Heavy fire.
Take cover!
Somebody shouts.
Take cover!
The meadows are flat. The wood is too far away and too dangerous. The only cover is the military cemetery and the grave mounds. We stumble into the darkness, and soon every man has flattened himself behind one of the mounds. Not a moment too soon. The dark turns into madness. It rocks and rages. Dark things, darker than the night itself, rush upon us in great waves, over us and onwards. The flashes of the explosions light up the cemetery. There is no way out. In the light of one of the shell bursts, I risk a glance out onto the meadows. They are like a storm-tossed sea, with the flames from the impacts spurting up like fountains. No one could possibly get across that. The wood disappears, splintered, shattered, smashed. We have to stay in the cemetery. The earth explodes in front of us. Great clumps of it come raining down on top of us. I feel a jolt. My sleeve has been ripped by some shrapnel. I clench my fist. No pain. But that is no comfort. Wounds never start to hurt until afterwards. I run my hand over the arm. It is scratched, but still in one piece. Then I get a knock on the head and everything blurs, but as quick as a flash comes the thought, you mustn't faint. I sink down into the black mud, but get up again immediately. A piece of shrapnel hit my helmet, but it came from so far off that it didn't cut through the steel. I wipe the dirt out of my eyes. A hole has been blown in the ground right in front of me. I can just about make it out. Shells don't often land in the same place twice, and I want to get into that hole. Without stopping, I wriggle across towards it as fast as I can, flat as an eel on the ground. There is a whistling noise again. I curl up quickly and grab for some cover, feel something to my left and press against it. It gives. I groan, and the earth is torn up again, the blast thunders in my ears. I crawl under whatever it was that gave way when I touched it, pull it over me. It is wood, cloth, cover, cover, pretty poor cover against falling shrapnel. I open my eyes. My fingers are gripped tight on a sleeve, an arm. A wounded soldier? I shout out to him. No answer. Must be dead. My hand gropes on and finds more shattered wood. Then I remember that we've taken cover in a cemetery. But the shelling is stronger than anything else. It wipes out all other considerations, and I just crawl deeper and deeper beneath the coffin so that it will protect me, even if death himself is already in it. The shell hole is gaping in front of me. I fix my eyes on it, grasping at it almost physically. I have to get to it in one jump. Then I feel a blow in the face, and a hand grabs me by the shoulder. Has the dead man come back to life? The hand shakes me, I turn my head, and in a flash of light that lasts only a second, I find myself looking into Kaczynski's face. His mouth is wide open, and he is bellowing, but I can't hear anything. He shakes me and comes closer. The noise ebbs for a moment, and I can make out his voice. Gas! 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 Pass it on. I pull out my gas mask case. Someone is lying a little way away from me. All I can think of is that I've got to tell him. Gas! Gas! I shout, crawl across to him, hit at him with the gas mask case, but he doesn't notice. I do it again and then again. He only ducks. It is one of the new recruits. I look despairingly at Kat, who has his mask on already. I tear mine out of the case. My helmet is knocked aside as I get the mask over my face. I reach the man, and his gas mask case is by my hand, so I get hold of the mask and shove it over his head. He grabs it. I let go, and with a sudden jolt I am lying in the shell hole. The dull thud of gas shells is mixed in with the sharp noise of high explosives. In between the explosions a bell rings the warning. Gongs and metal rattles spread the word. Gas! 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 There is a noise as someone drops behind me, once, twice. I wipe the window of my gas mask clear of condensation. It is Kat, Krop, and somebody else. There are four of us lying here, tensed and waiting, breathing as shallowly as we can. The first few minutes with the mask tell you whether you will live or die. Is it airtight? I know the terrible sights from the field hospital. Soldiers who have been gassed, choking for days on end as they spew up their burned-out lungs bit by bit. I breathe carefully, with my mouth pressed against the mouthpiece. By now the gas is snaking over the ground and sinking into all the hollows. It insinuates itself into our shell hole, wriggling its way in like a broad, soft jellyfish. I give Kat a nudge. It is better to crawl out and lie up on top rather than here, where the gas concentrates itself the most. But we can't. A second hail of shellfire starts. It's as if it is not the guns that are roaring. It's as if the very earth is raging. There is a crash as something black flies over and onto us. It strikes the ground right beside us, a coffin that has been blown through the air. I see Kat move and crawl across to him. The coffin has crashed down onto the outstretched arm of the fourth man in our shell hole. He tries to tear off his gas mask with his other hand. Krop gets to him just in time, twists that arm hard behind his back and holds it there. Kat and I set about freeing the wounded arm. The coffin lid is loose and damaged, and we easily manage to wrench it free. We throw out the corpse, which flops down, and then we try to loosen the rest of the coffin. Luckily, the man passes out, and Albert is able to help us. Now we don't have to be so careful, and we work like mad until the coffin gives way with a sighing noise to the spades which we shove in underneath it. It is lighter now. Kat takes a piece of the coffin lid and puts it under the shattered arm, and we wrap the bandages from all our field dressing packs around it. There isn't anything else we can do at the moment. My head is throbbing and buzzing in the gas mask. It is nearly bursting. Your lungs get strained. They only have stagnant, overheated, used-up air to breathe. The veins on your temples bulge and you think you are going to suffocate. A grey light trickles into our shell hole. Wind sweeps the cemetery. I haul myself up to the edge of the hole. Lying in front of me in the dirty light of dawn is a leg that has been torn off, with the boot on it still completely undamaged. I see it all perfectly clearly in a moment. But now, a few yards away, somebody is standing up. I clean the goggles, and because I am agitated, they mist over again at once. But I stare across. The man over there isn't wearing his gas mask anymore. I wait a few seconds longer, but he doesn't collapse. He looks around cautiously and takes a few steps. The wind has dispersed the gas. The air is clear. And gasping for breath, I rip my mask away from my face too, and my knees give way. The air pours into me like cold water. My eyes feel as if they could burst from my head. The wave sweeps over me and plunges me into darkness. The shelling has stopped. I turn back to the crater and wave to the others. They scramble up and tear off their masks. We pick up the wounded man, one of us holds the arm with the splint on it. And in a group we stumble away as quickly as possible. The cemetery has been blown to pieces. Coffins and corpses are scattered all around. They have been killed for a second time. But every corpse that was shattered saved the life of one of us. The fence has been wrecked, the rails of the field railway on the other side have been ripped out and bent upwards, so that they point to the sky. Someone is lying on the ground in front of us. We stop. Crop goes on alone with the wounded man. The man on the ground is a recruit. He has blood smeared all over one hip. He is so exhausted that I reach for my flask, which has tea with rum in it. Cat holds back my hand and bends over him.
Where did you cop it, mate?
He moves his eyes, too weak to answer. Carefully, we cut away his trousers. He moans.
It's okay, okay. It'll soon be better.
If he's been hit in the stomach, then he mustn't drink anything. He is thrown up, and that is a good sign. We expose the hip area. It is just a pulp of torn flesh and splintered bone. The joint has been hit. This lad will never walk again. I wet my fingers and run them across his forehead, then give him a drink. Some life comes into his eyes. It's only now that we realize that his right arm is bleeding as well. Cat spreads out two field dressings as wide as he can so that they cover the wound. I look around for some cloth so that I can tie it up loosely. We haven't got anything, so I cut more of the wounded man's trousers away so that I can use a piece of his underpants as a bandage. But he isn't wearing any. I look at him more closely. It's the blonde lad from earlier on. Meanwhile, Cat has fetched a couple more field dressings from the pockets of dead soldiers, and we place them carefully on the wound. The lad is looking at us with a fixed gaze.
We'll go and get a stretcher now.
But he opens his mouth and whispers,
Stay here.
Cat says,
We'll be back in a minute. We're going to get a stretcher for you.
It is impossible to say whether he understands or not. He whimpers like a child behind us as we go.
Stay here.
Cat looks all round and then whispers,
Wouldn't it be best just to take a revolver and put him out of his misery?
The lad is not likely to survive being moved, and at the very most he'll last a couple of days. But everything he's been through so far will be nothing compared to those few days until he dies. At the moment he is still in shock and can't feel anything. Within an hour he'll be a screaming mass of unbearable agonies, and the few days he still has left to live will just be an incessant raging torture. And what difference does it make to anyone whether he has to suffer them or not? I nod.
You're right, Cat. The best thing would be a bullet.
Give me a gun, he says, and stops walking. I can see that he is set on it. We look around, but we're not alone anymore. A small group is gathering near us, and heads are appearing out of the shell holes and trenches. We bring a stretcher. Cat shakes his head.
Such young lads.
He says it again.
Such young, innocent lads.
Our losses are not as bad as might have been expected. 5 dead and 8 wounded. It was only a short barrage. 2 of our dead are lying in one of the reopened graves. All we have to do is fill it in. We go back. We trot along silently in line, one behind the other. The wounded are taken to the dressing station. The morning is overcast. The orderlies scurry about with tags and numbers. The wounded whimper. It starts to rain. Within an hour, we reach our truck and climb aboard. There is more room on it now than there was before. The rain gets heavier. We open up tarpaulins and put them over our heads. The drops drum down on top of them. Streams of rain pour off the sides. The trucks splash through the holes in the road and we rock backwards and forwards, half asleep. 2 men at the front of the truck have long forked poles with them. They watch out for the telephone wires that hang down so low across the roadway that they could take your head off. The 2 men make sure they get them with their forked sticks and lift them over our heads. We hear them shouting, "Mind the wires!" And still half asleep, we bob down and then straighten up again. The trucks roll monotonously onwards. The shouts are monotonous. The falling rain is monotonous. It falls on our heads and on the heads of the dead men up at the front of the truck, on the body of the little recruit with a wound that is far too big for his hip. It's falling on Kemmerish's grave, and it's falling in our hearts. From somewhere we hear the sound of a shell burst. We snap to, our eyes wide open, our hands ready again to heave our bodies over the side of the truck into the ditch by the roadside. But we don't hear any more. Just the monotonous shouts of, "Mind the wires!" We bob down. We're half asleep again.